the conventions due to their construction on the occupied territories. The UN Security Council has condemned Israel's settlement activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Hossein al-Sheikh, a senior Palestinian official, welcomed the joint statement by Western powers condemning Tel Aviv's plan to build more illegal settlements, but said action needed to be taken. In a statement on Twitter, he said, "We demand that words be turned to deeds." Hardliners who oppose Palestinian statehood comprise a large part of Israel's new cabinet, which has put settlement construction at the top of its priorities. Extremist Israeli minister Bezalel Smotrich said about 10,000 new homes are to be approved. Smotrich said he and his allies were committed to removing completely the restrictions on building in the occupied West Bank. Today, between 600,000 and 750,000 Israelis live in these seizable settlements, equivalent to roughly 11% of the total Jewish Israeli population. The Palestinians seek those territories for a future independent state. Since then, the Tel Aviv regime has openly funded and built settlements for Israeli Jews to live there, offering incentives and subsidized housing. Their statements by the Western powers will likely have little effect on the Israeli hardliners. The regime has never been subjected to real sanctions or accountability. The Israelis have never suffered any pressure, so they keep doing what they're doing. 2022 was the deadliest year for Palestinians in the West Bank since the United Nations started keeping records in 2005. Over 140 Palestinians were killed in the West Bank last year. But already this year, we are only halfway through the second month of 2023, and Israel has already killed around 50 Palestinians in the West Bank. Israel has also regularly bombed Gaza, and now, with a right-wing cabinet in place, the situation is only expected to get worse. Israel's far-right cabinet has approved the legislation for 9 settler outposts in the occupied West Bank. All settlements are illegal according to international law, but who pays attention to international law in this occupied land? Years of war in Syria has destabilized the region, which is still suffering from an ongoing humanitarian emergency. Millions are displaced within Syria or have fled to Turkey, which is contending with high inflation and a deepening economic crisis. The earthquake unleashed widespread damage and destruction in some of the most at-risk areas in the region. A magnitude 7.8 earthquake struck near Nurdaghi in southern Turkey around 4:17 a.m. local time on February 6th. A magnitude 7.5 earthquake followed around later that afternoon around 1 p.m. local time, along with scores of powerful aftershocks. Thousands are injured and thousands more remain trapped in the rubble, and the chance of finding survivors gets narrower and narrower. Search and recovery operations continue with assistance from teams around the world. But freezing weather is hampering rescue efforts and making it even more difficult to access possible survivors. This catastrophe hit an already fragile region, which has been marked by decades of war in Syria and economic, humanitarian, and public health crises. Turkey is facing a profound economic crisis, with a collapsing currency and extraordinary inflation that hit around 80% last year, the highest in about 25 years. The quake-hit part of Turkey also hosts a large population of Syrian refugees. The economic crisis in Turkey has helped fuel a backlash against the approximately 3.6 million Syrian refugees in the country, who are already facing poverty, discrimination, an increase in violent attacks, and the risk of deportation. More than 2 million people in northwestern Syria are also at risk of a deadly cholera outbreak. The outbreak began in northeastern Syria, attributed to contaminated water from the Euphrates River, which people were relying on in part because of the water infrastructure destroyed by years of fighting. About 47% of people in Syria rely on unsafe drinking water, a potentially even bigger risk after the massive infrastructure damage by the earthquake. In northwest Syria, in particular, this outbreak was straining an already stretched and under-resourced health system, which will now also need to find ways to treat those injured in the earthquake. The devastation extends beyond northwest Syria, as the country as a whole has been overwhelmed by years of war and destruction. International sanctions against Syria are also deepening the economic crisis Syrians face. The country faces record and widespread poverty and food shortages. About 90% of Syrians live below the poverty line, and nearly 75% struggle to meet their most basic needs. And across the region, the crisis is still acute, as agencies and officials rush to find survivors in the rubbles and temperatures drop. The earthquake compounds catastrophe upon catastrophe in Syria and Turkey. It is likely to exacerbate those that already exist while creating new, unpredictable ones. The United Nations Secretary General says Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has agreed to open two more border crossings to facilitate relief aid delivery to the northern part of the quake-hit country, which is held by militants. Antonio Guterres announced the development after Assad approved the use of Bab al-Salam and al-Ra'i crossings, which link Turkey to northwestern Syria for outreach purposes. In line with the presidential decree, the crossings would be open for an initial period of 3 months to allow for the timely delivery of humanitarian aid. In addition to authorizing transit through the border passages, the UN chief said facilitating humanitarian access, accelerating visa approvals, and easing travel between hubs will allow more aid to go in faster. The announcement was made after the UN Security Council held a closed-door session on the humanitarian situation in Syria following the quake. The 7.8 magnitude quake that hit Turkey and neighboring Syria last Monday has so far claimed tens of thousands of lives. The biggest part of the fatalities that have been caused in Syria have occurred in the territory which is being held by Takfiri terrorist groups. The approval issued by Assad came after the UN lamented that an anti-government group, which has been designated as terrorist by the international community, was preventing aid consignments from being delivered to the quake-hit areas in the northern part of Syria. A spokesman for the UN's Humanitarian Aid Office said on Sunday that there were issues with approval by the group, which was identified as a terrorist outfit, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS. Previously, a number of captured Takfiri terrorists had confessed to close cooperation to U.S. military forces in Syria. There have also been reports of U.S. supporting Takfiri terrorists and helping them to expand across Syria. Also on Sunday, Reuters quoted an HTS source who spoke on the condition of anonymity as confirming that the terror outfit will not let in shipments from government-held parts of Syria, alleging, "We won't allow the government to take advantage of the situation to show they are helping."
The Russia-Ukraine war is about to enter its first anniversary within days. So far, thousands of people have been killed and many more displaced. Now, after nearly 1 year, the war has turned into a bigger conflict, an encounter, rather, between the West and Russia. Many countries, including the U.S., Germany, France, and the U.K., have been fanning the flames of the conflict by sending military aids worth billions of dollars. In the U.S., there has been a long debate among politicians on whether to support Kiev in its war with Russia. Some back the U.S. support for Ukraine. Others, however, take a different stance. Among them is Congressman Matt Gaetz. The Republican lawmaker has introduced a bill which calls for an immediate end to U.S. military and financial support for Ukraine. The resolution also urges the warring sides to negotiate a ceasefire.
How much more for Ukraine? Is there any limit? Which billionth dollar really kicks in the door? Which red line we set will we not later cross?
Throughout the war, Gaetz has been critical of U.S. support for Ukraine and has previously called for an end to the policy.
I will not vote for one more dollar to Ukraine. I will not vote for one more piece of materiel to Ukraine. We are far too entangled in this conflict. I believe we have extended this conflict. And I call on the Secretary of Defense to declassify the Inspector General report on the compliance with our existing regulations regarding chain of custody with materiel going to another country.
Gates has also taken a jab at President Joe Biden. In a statement on his resolution, Gates said President Joe Biden must have forgotten his prediction from March 2022, suggesting that arming Ukraine with military equipment will escalate the conflict to World War III. He added America is in a state of managed decline, and it will exacerbate if we continue to hemorrhage taxpayer dollars toward a foreign war. We must suspend all foreign aid for the war in Ukraine and demand that all combatants in this conflict reach a peace agreement immediately. Gates' resolution has so far received 10 co-sponsors, including Andy Biggs from Arizona, Lauren Boebert from Colorado, Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia, Anna Paulina Luna from Florida, Thomas Massey from Kentucky, and Mary Miller from Illinois. The bill introduced by Gates notes that the U.S. has already authorized over $110 billion to spend on the war in less than a year. The resolution comes after a series of escalations of U.S. military aid, including M1 Abrams tanks. It also comes at a time when Ukraine is seeking fighter jets from the U.S. and its allies. Each escalation risks a direct clash between Russia and NATO, which could quickly spiral into a nuclear war. But where does this rising U.S. opposition to continue aid to Ukraine come from? If U.S. taxpayers knew that half the income tax dollars that they sent to the Internal Revenue Service every year was being spent on weapons, war, and war preparation, political support for such programs might significantly decline. As a matter of fact, no agency of the federal government communicates to taxpayers how Congress spends their money. Purchasing weapons and military services with taxpayer dollars has always been, and continues to be, a highly profitable endeavor for defense contractors. But it is in a real war, like as in Ukraine, that such profiteering truly thrives. President Joe Biden's budget proposal to Congress for 2023 included $813 billion for the Pentagon and military expenditures. This is more than half the income taxes citizens send to the federal government each year, and a more than $31 billion increase over the already bloated fiscal year 2022 Pentagon budget. It is also more than the defense budgets of the eight next biggest military spenders put together, including Russia, China, and India. One of the components of the $782 billion Pentagon budget is for the purchase of new nuclear-armed submarines, even though the U.S. already has 14 lethal Ohio-class submarines, each capable of launching 192 nuclear warheads. Canceling two of these unnecessary and provocative new weapon systems would save more than $10 billion. All in all, what seems to be a non-negotiable is the U.S. taxpayers' money, which could and can be allocated to other needs. What seems to be clear, not only to American taxpayers, but to the whole world, is that the U.S. military-industrial complex is the only one who benefits most from such aid.
In the limelight.
The World Bank has predicted that the world's economy will face a sharp decline in 2023 due to soaring inflation and soaring interest rates. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Reuters news agency has covered this story and tells us more. The World Bank slashed its 2023 growth forecast on Tuesday, 10th of December, to levels teetering on the brink of recession for many countries as the impact of central bank interest rate hikes intensifies. Russia's special operation in Ukraine continues, and the world's major economies engines sputter. The development lender said it now expected global gross domestic product growth of 1.7% in 2023, the slowest pace outside the 2009 and 2020 recessions in nearly three decades. In its previous Global Economic Prospects report in June of 2022, the World Bank had forecast 2023 global growth at 3%. The bank said major slowdowns in advanced economies, including sharp cuts to its forecast to 0.5% for both the United States and the Eurozone, could foreshadow a new global recession less than 3 years after the last one. The World Bank said in a statement accompanying the report, "Given fragile economic conditions, any new adverse development, such as higher-than-expected inflation, abrupt rises in interest rates to contain it, a resurgence of the COVID-19 pandemic, or escalating geopolitical tensions could push the global economy into recession." The World Bank said the bleak outlook will be especially hard on emerging markets and developing economies as they struggle with heavy debt burdens, weak currencies and income growth, and slowing business investment that is now forecast at a 3.5% annual growth rate over the next 2 years, less than half the pace of the past two decades. World Bank President David Malpass said in a statement, "Weakness in growth and business investment will compound the already devastating reversals in education, health, poverty and infrastructure, and the increasing demands from climate change." The World Bank report said China's economic growth in 2022 slumped to 2.7%, its second slowest pace since the mid-1970s. After 2020, as zero COVID restrictions, property market turmoil and drought hit consumption in China. Production and investments were also lower. It predicted a rebound to 4.3% for 2023, but that is 0.9 percentage point below the June forecast due to the severity of the COVID disruptions and weakening external demand. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. In its half-yearly health check, the Washington-based World Bank said it had cut its 2023 growth forecast from 2.9% to 1.7% after the risk it identified 6 months ago all materialized. The World Bank's Global Economic Prospects report said the tougher-than-anticipated anti-inflationary measures, persistently high energy prices and continued lockdowns in China had led to a much weaker outlook for this year than it had expected last summer. Almost every advanced nation and nearly 70% of emerging and developing nations have had their economic growth forecasts cut. The World Bank's mission is to reduce poverty, and its president, David Malpass, said the deterioration in the global economic outlook meant the crisis facing development was intensifying. David Malpass said, "Emerging and developing countries are facing a multi-year period of slow growth, driven by heavy debt burdens and weak investment, as global capital is absorbed by advanced economies, faced with extremely high government debt levels and rising interest rates." The World Bank President David Malpass added, "The deterioration is broad-based. In virtually all regions of the world, per capita income growth will be slower than it was during the decade before COVID-19. The setback to global prosperity will likely persist." The World Bank said growth in the more prosperous advanced economies is projected to slow from 2.5% in 2022 to just 0.5 percentage point in 2023, adding that in the past two decades, slowdowns on a similar scale had resulted in global recession. Excluding China, growth in emerging market and developing economies, is expected to decelerate from 3.8% in 2022 to 2.7% in 2023. The World Bank said in sub-Saharan Africa, which accounts for about 60% of the world's extremely poor, growth in per capita income over 2023-2024 is expected to average just 1.2%, a rate that could cause poverty rates to rise, not fall. In fragile and conflict-affected countries, per capita incomes are expected to decline by 2024. World Bank President David Malpass said investment growth in emerging market and developing economies was predicted to be 3.5% a year between 2022 and 2024, half the average rate increase seen in the previous two decades. He added much-needed capital was being diverted to richer countries. The English website of Al Jazeera Television Network has also covered the same story. The head of the International Monetary Fund, IMF, warned this year will be tougher than 2022 for most of the global economy as the United States, the European Union and China see slowing economic growth. The International Monetary Fund's managing director, Kristalina Georgieva, said 2023 will be a tough year, with one-third of the world's economies expected to be in recession. Georgieva said during the appearance of the CBS program Face the Nation, she said, because the three big economies, the United States, the European Union and China, are all slowing down simultaneously. The remarks come after the International Monetary Fund back in October cut its growth forecast to 2.7%, down from 2.9% forecast in July, amid headwinds including the war in Ukraine and sharply rising interest rates. IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva said China, the world's second largest economy, is likely to grow at or below global growth for the first time in the past 40 years, as COVID-19 cases surge following the dismantling of its zero-COVID policy. Georgieva said she expected China's economic growth to improve towards the end of the year, but there are concerns about its longer-term trajectory. Meanwhile, economists said the lingering energy crisis is expected to cause further recession in the Eurozone this year. Economists said prices in the region will rise by an average of over 6%, and unemployment rate will increase from the current 6.5% to 7.1%, by the end of 2023. High inflation and energy shortages will lead to a further decline in production and worsen the situation in the labour market. Subsequently, by the end of the year, the Eurozone economy will shrink by 0.01%. Chiara Zangarelli, an economist at Morgan Stanley, said, "Gas markets in Europe remain a key risk. Additional supply disruptions or a particularly cold winter could lead to renewed tensions and prices rising again, forcing another round of adaptation and demand destruction."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Start. Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
Islamadi, Allah my Lord,
His word Quran,
Muhammad Prophet,
praise be upon
I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Dear listeners, my dear sisters and brothers, welcome to a new episode of Youth Station. Thank you for being with us.
Me? Okay. Thank you. You're welcome.
Thank you for being here.
Thank me for being here.
Yeah, how are you?
Alhamdulillah. Can't complain. I'm good.
Why can't you complain? Yes, you can.
Well, I don't think it brings any good. You know, complaining doesn't bring you nothing. You know,
really?
Yeah, you rather just get up, you know, move on.
I guess people don't think so right now. Nowadays, people are thinking differently. They complain about every single thing.
I know, right?
Yeah.
And if you make complaining, ranting a part of yourself, no matter where you stand in society, no matter where you stand in your own life, you're still going to carry on doing that, right?
Yeah.
If you're complaining about everything and you're poor, right, financially.
Economical issues.
Yeah, like, I'm not looking down on poor people because I might be one of those people.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying.
Yes, everyone can be.
Yeah, everyone can be. But if you are that person, even if you're a billionaire, you'd be complaining about how Gucci ran out of that purse stock that you
wanted. So we always have a reason to complain.
Exactly. You'll find a reason to complain if that has become a part.
There's always a way to find that.
Yeah.
As human beings. But, you know, throughout the history of human beings, we could see that the concept of good and bad has changed.
Yeah, as in complaining was bad.
Actually, cultures.
They play a big role in that too, right? Because in some cultures...
What about education?
What do you mean?
I mean, in past, maybe people didn't know about many things. But right now, they all go to universities and they read books, perhaps, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And they start to feel like they have to find something to complain about.
Yeah.
Actually, we're not talking about complaining, but as an example, it got through the way.
Yeah, okay, that's a good example. In a certain culture, complaining per se might not be as bad as it is in another culture, right?
Yeah, I get it.
In one culture, complaining might be the way to start a conversation, right? Oh, how have you been? Oh, don't even ask me, you understand? And they just go on and keep on ranting.
That's very familiar
about things,
to me,
you understand, right? And in another culture, like, no matter, like, what you're going through, you have to be like, oh, yeah, everything's good. And you have to have this face and you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so it's clear from the appearance of society.
Yeah. So if, as you said, like things have changed, good and bad has changed, that might play a role in
So you say in this fact being changed, the concept of good and bad being changed has got a relation with culture.
To an extent. Not absolutely, but to an extent, right?
What about morality? But before we get into morality, let's go for a short break and then we'll be back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So we are talking about the concept of good and bad, which has been changed throughout time. I said about
education, right?
Yeah.
You mentioned education and that, and like how times have changed.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the days, if I was there. I'm like, back when social media and like televised broadcasting wasn't television.
When technology was not this improved.
Technology, yeah. There we go. Wasn't as widespread as it is right now.
Yeah.
The good and evil in cultures might have stayed within those cultures.
Uh-huh.
And like, might have seeped into cultures or societies bordering those places, right?
Yeah.
But now, certain things have happened, as I would say, is there's one universal culture, right?
Yeah.
The world has got its own culture now.
Mm-hmm.
And side by side, right? Besides that, there are individual countries that have, or like areas or continents that have got their own cultures.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So in terms of that... saying that good and evil has changed might be relative because in a certain society, something was bad right? It was
evil.
Yeah,
but right now it's no longer bad.
Why? Because in another society, it was not evil, right? Now that the world has become a universal culture, right? That thing from like the X point of the globe, which was positive, has seeped in.
It has been spreaded to them.
Yeah, that place. So technology might have played a very...
I would say also morality has got a way in this time.
Yeah, okay. So if you're talking about things that have to do with morality, certainly.
Yeah.
Right. Now, morality, you can't even define it anymore.
Exactly. This is the point. Yeah. You can't define it. And we cannot say who's moral and who's immoral.
Well, I wish we could. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, why do you think, like, you can't define morality anymore? Like, why? Morality for me right now, for example, is something that is so built in within your nature. It's like something about your consciousness.
Intuitively, you have it.
Yeah. Why is it not why can it not be defined anymore?
Because every single thing that every one of us is doing right now has got a justification for it. We all have a justification for it. And when I give that reason to you, then you might sympathize with me and say, yes, it's true. Who knows what's truth in the eyes of God?
Okay, but like, there are certain things that, well, being Muslims, right, I don't want no offense to people who don't believe in God, whatever, but being a Muslim, there are certain things that are definitely
the
wrong.
In the
eyes of God, right?
Yeah.
And there are people who'd bring up justifications for that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hideous people, horrible crimes. You understand?
Yeah.
And horrible, horrible things that people would do. And some ex-psychologist would say, oh, it goes back to his childhood. Or like, you know, come up with this ludicrous idea.
Exactly.
That's
what I'm saying. Psychology many times comes to their help. To many people's help.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? Well, those psychologists have been proven wrong over and over and over and over and over.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And no one can say, oh, well, you know, psychology is knowledge. It's a science. And, well, it's true. No, it's not, because it's theories.
No, let's not eradicate it totally.
No,
I would
I'm
say
not
they,
about,
like, they have revealed something.
Certainly they have. But, like, you can't label
but
one person.
But it can't be a gospel truth.
No, it can't. Yeah. One person specifically, right? Like, if I'm saying psychology, then I have to consider views and theories of other psychologists as well.
Exactly,
you know, so like it has to be comparative, right?
And there's always someone who's for and some other one who's against.
Exactly,
yeah.
Right? So horrible crimes, right, that are absolutely detrimental to someone's morality, or the world's morality, universal morality, some guy's going to come up with an excuse, with a justification.
Before, actually, I say we have to go for the break, let me just give you the topic that we're talking about for after the break. I would say there's another reason, which is freedom. But let's go for a break, and then we'll come back to talk about it.
Let's go.
Welcome back. This is Youth Station. We're still here and we're talking about the concept of good and bad, which has been changed throughout time. And we talked about many things, actually, the cultural reasons and then the technology. Mm. And also we talked about morality as well. And I just said freedom. Under the pretext of freedom.
Freedom like what? Freedom of speech or freedom just in general?
Just in general. Under the pretext of freedom, people do many things and then they justify it. And then through the reasons they would bring for me, then I would say, yes, they're right.
Right. But like, how do we define freedom? Like in general, Western philosophers have
defined
freedom.
See, when you
freedom.
Talk about everyday life, there's no philosophy and there's no scientific, I don't know, factual thing that you could bring. People would go for everything as it is.
Fair
when
enough,
I say
like,
freedom, what comes to a normal, ordinary person's mind
exactly,
is
right. that,
just all sort of freedom.
Fair enough. But like, everyone has to define something, right?
Yeah.
When whoever it is, right, be it someone literate, illiterate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But believe it or not, both of them,
right.
when you say freedom,
okay.
they just come to the fact that freedom is actually ranging all different forms of freedom.
All right, fair enough. But like, if you ask them, how do you define freedom? You know, this is actually...
I do whatever I like to do.
All right, fair enough, right? So the question is, do you only have the right to freedom, or everyone else does too?
Everyone has.
Right, fair enough. That's where the definition comes in.
Yeah.
They say that if whatever you do, right,
yeah,
does not take away a certain right of another person,
mm-hmm,
within those boundaries, whatever you do is freedom.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So even freedom has boundaries, right?
Yeah.
So whatever I want to do, if that has no boundaries,
uh-huh,
no tab put on there, then, if my freedom is affecting someone else's freedom, then that's not really freedom because...
But they don't think about it.
Exactly, right? So if I'm thinking about my freedom and the person in front of me is also only thinking about his freedom,
mm-hmm,
then there's war.
Yeah.
There's no freedom.
Exactly,
understand?
Yeah.
Right, that's where slavery and prisoners and... yeah, exactly, that those things come in, right?
Yeah. Just in order to bring us back to the main topic, which was the concept of good and bad, which has been changed, I would talk about archetypal pattern. In psychology, Jung talked about these archetypal patterns and said, for example, black is for evil. Whenever we think of black, the only thing that comes to our mind is something evil, something dark, something depressive, whatever of these sorts, you know?
Okay.
And then white, every one of us, when we think of white, we remember purity or whatever. These are, mm-hmm, the codes that we have them in our mind.
Okay.
So I usually think of...
that's also cultural. I'm going to interfere, but that's also cultural.
How come?
Because in certain cultures...
See, no, I'm just giving you the reason. Ever since we're...
Let me answer when you ask me a question. You said, how come? Let me answer how come.
I'm surprised.
In certain cultures, red is a sign of happiness. In other cultures, red is a sign of sorrow.
How come?
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. So, okay.
No, there's the majority, and then there's the minority.
No.
See, exceptions don't break the rules.
Right. Yeah, you're right. Exceptions don't. But
as in general,
okay,
black is for darkness, for depression, for evilness, and things like this,
okay,
as in general. So I'm just, I just brought this into our topic, mm-hmm, just to say that the good and bad are clear. Ever since we're born, mm-hmm, we know what is good and what is bad. And we have it in the Holy Book of Quran also. The path of truth and the path of wrong deeds are shown to us, are given to us as if we know it, as if it runs in our blood, as if we know it intuitively.
Mm-hmm.
But then what happens to us that we ignore it?
Yeah. You see, someone might say, I'm not ignoring anything. You're the one who's ignoring it. Why? Because now the stance have changed.
Yeah.
And what I think is it comes back to morality, right? When when some people say morality is relative and what pleases me or brings ease to me in whatever manner is my morality,
mm-hmm,
Then there is no clear definition of morality left anymore, right?
Yes.
So, I think that's the problem.
That's all the time that we have for today. You know, we could still talk a lot about it.
Yeah.
But we just are giving some hints and clues, and that's all, because time is running so fast.
Man. Yeah, well, that's about you, Station, because the train's moving and, you know.
They should give us more of time. So
I know.
We plead for more time. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us. I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, I just bid you farewell from me and from Brother Najafi. So, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Limelight. A new report has revealed that the U.S. lied about Afghan civilians killed in 2021 drone strike. Reports say U.S. officials knew the strike killed 10 family members, including 7 children. They covered it up for over a year. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote in this regard, "Erroneous assumptions and biases by U.S. analysts led to the Kabul drone attack that killed 10 civilians, including 7 children, during the Pentagon's chaotic August 2021 withdrawal from Afghanistan. An internal military investigation has reportedly found. Tensions were running high on the day of the drone strike, just 3 days after the August 26 terrorist bombing that killed 13 U.S. troops and more than 100 Afghans at the Kabul airport. The probe by U.S. Central Command, CENTCOM, noted that another attack by ISIS was expected that day and that intelligence reports indicated it would involve a white Toyota Corolla, the New York Times reported recently. Military analysts observed a white Corolla stopping at what they believed was an ISIS compound, so they began tracking the car, the report said. After the vehicle pulled into a gated courtyard near the airport hours later, a Hellfire missile strike on the car by an MQ-9 Reaper drone was ordered. Later that day, U.S. officials announced that they had successfully prevented another terrorist bombing. As reports of civilian deaths began to surface, U.S. officials said they had no indications of such casualties and were investigating whether a secondary explosion might have killed someone. However, the Times said CENTCOM's investigation revealed that analysts reported within 20 minutes of the strike that civilians may have been killed. Within 3 hours, they had assessed that at least 3 children were killed. Military officials continued to conceal what they knew about the strike. 3 days later, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley said the attack was righteous and that it had killed an ISIS facilitator and unknown others. The driver of the Corolla turned out to be an aid worker who had spent the day picking up his employer's laptop, taking colleagues to and from work, and loading canisters of water into his trunk to bring home to his family. The CENTCOM investigation was completed a week and a half after the drone strike and was never released to the public, the Times said. 16 months later, the newspaper obtained 66 partially redacted pages of the report only after suing CENTCOM under the Freedom of Information Act. The probe detailed how biases led analysts to make tragically wrong assumptions. For instance, they concluded that a package loaded into the car contained explosives because of its careful handling and size, and that the driver's erratic route meant he was trying to evade surveillance. Meanwhile, Truthout noted in this regard, U.S. military officials knew that an August 2021 drone strike in Kabul likely killed Afghan civilians, including children, but lied about it. A report published recently revealed New York Times investigative reporter Azmat Khan analyzed a 66-page redacted U.S. Central Command report on the August 29, 2021 drone strike that killed 10 members of the Ahmadi family, including 7 children, outside their home in the Afghan capital. The strike took place during the chaotic final days of the U.S. ground war in Afghanistan just 3 days after a bombing that killed at least 182 people, including 13 American troops, at Kabul's international airport. Zamari Ahmadi, a 43-year-old aid worker for California-based nonprofit Nutrition and Education International, was carrying water containers that were mistaken for explosives when his Toyota Corolla was bombed by a Lockheed Martin Hellfire missile fired from a General Atomics MQ-9 Reaper drone. As reports of civilian casualties began circulating hours after the strike, U.S. military officials claimed there were no indications that non-combatants were harmed in the attack, while stating that they would investigate whether a secondary explosion may have killed or wounded people nearby. U.S. military officials initially claimed the righteous strike had prevented an imminent new attack on the airport. However, they later admitted that the botched bombing was a horrible mistake. The military's investigation was completed less than 2 weeks after the strike. However, it was never released to the public. The Pentagon said it would not punish anyone for killing the Ahmadi family. However, as the Times details, portions of a U.S. Central Command investigation obtained by the New York Times show that military analysts reported within minutes of the strike that civilians may have been killed and within 3 hours had assessed that at least 3 children were killed. The documents also provide detailed examples of how assumptions and biases led to the deadly blunder. Military analysts wrongly concluded, for example, that a package loaded into the car contained explosives because of its careful handling and size, and that the driver's erratic route was evidence that he was trying to evade surveillance. Furthermore, the investigation refers to an additional surveillance drone not under military control that was also tracking the vehicle but does not specify what it observed. The Times confirmed that the drone was operated by the CIA and observed children, possibly in the car, moments before impact, as CNN had reported. Hina Shamsi, an ACLU attorney representing families of the victims of the strike, told the Times that the investigation makes clear that U.S. military personnel saw what they wanted to see and not reality, which was an Afghan aid worker going about his daily life. When confirmation bias was so deadly in this case, you have to ask how many other people targeted by the U.S. military over the years were also unjustly killed, Shamsi added. Daphne Evitar, who heads Amnesty International's Security with Human Rights Program, called the new report more evidence than we need a huge change in how U.S. uses lethal force and assesses and reveals its consequences.
IRIB English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to IRIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? with us. This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with a number of eulogists, and religious poets in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on January 12, 2023. The meeting took place one day before the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha. Today, there are thousands of people across the country who are engaged in the work of reciting elegies and are mastering various techniques for attracting their audiences. This is a great phenomenon that is taking place in the country, and we need to take advantage of it. Who should use this opportunity? I'm not saying that it should be used by me, government officials, or by this person or that person. I'm saying it should be used by the country, by the system, and by the revolution. The revolution must make use of this opportunity. This revolution needs to progress. It needs to make changes on a daily basis. You can play a role in this. That is what I am trying to say. You need to spread awareness in the country about the fight against tyrants, oppressors, the arrogant powers, and corruption. The problem with what we are doing in most places is that we direct people, we give advice, and we provide reasons and rationalize, but these things are not effective. Why? Because the public atmosphere is not in accordance with what we had intended. I have on numerous occasions insisted on the work that needs to be done in building culture. What you can do is to focus on culture building.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Sometimes we may need the country to stand up to the enemy or retaliate. At other times, the country needs to pursue knowledge and science, and sometimes it may be necessary to create an environment for thinking and reflection. We need to prepare the environment for these. I've already talked about the subject of family and raising children. You can play a far greater role than the Ministry of Health and the like in this field. You can give people encouragement, insight, and hope. As you can see, one of the enemy's most important tactics today is to create despair. Where? At the core of the country's existence. That is, in the youth. It uses all kinds of methods and tricks to create despair in their minds. What you can do is to do the exact opposite. You can give hope. You can work on guiding thoughts and actions, but there is a condition. If you wish to have the honor of doing these things, the first and foremost condition is that you be concerned about guiding people. An elegist should be concerned with guiding his audience rather than earning money, fame, social status, and such things.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puriza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Thursday, Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah warned the United States and its allies that its attempts to stir chaos in the country will not be fruitful.
I'll tell the U.S., if you create chaos in Lebanon, then you will witness chaos in the entire region. If you target our people with your conspiracies, then we will use our power and arms to make you feel pain, even if this means war against your beloved Israel.
The leader of the resistance group also said that the 2019 protests in Lebanon were merely part of a U.S. ploy, which took advantage of weaknesses in the country as part of a new strategy after the failure of direct military invasions.
Lebanon has, from the year 2019, been the target of a new U.S. plot. First, it's a plot to eradicate the achievements and the victories of the resistance and its martyrs. And second, it's a plot to take Lebanon back to being under the hegemony of the U.S., which wants to impose its conditions on the country's domestic affairs and its conditions on relations with the enemy.
Nasrallah, who addressed people during the memorial ceremony of three of Hezbollah's martyred leaders, also emphasized that supporters of the resistance group who are suffering from economic crisis will continue to support the group. Observers believe that all stalemates in Lebanon, whether the inability to elect a president or lack of economic reforms, are all the result of a wave of subtle interference by the U.S.
The U.S. is pressurizing Lebanon economically to impose its conditions and bring to power a president who is loyal to Washington and is not friendly with the resistance, so that it can implement its policies by means of soft power. Having said that, it would not seem that the U.S. has launched a war on Lebanon or the resistance. While it would seem this is an internal Lebanese affair, this is where the threat lies in their plots.
Nasrallah also touched upon the issue of offshore oil and gas exploration, saying Hezbollah will hinder Israel's production of gas from oil fields should procrastination by the companies who have contracts with Lebanon continue.
After assassination of any prominent leader of Hezbollah, the resistance would go through a landmark transformation. Now, in light of what analysts see as a massive U.S. attempt to choke Lebanon politically and economically, the resistance progress is unhindered. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
A little crumbling space filled with dirt and garbage. Rohingya refugee camp on the outskirts of New Delhi is no more than an open prison for the members of the community who face constant threats and intimidation from law enforcement agencies. They say all their activities are being monitored and reported to the local police station on a daily basis. A member of the community is given that task, but that is not the only trouble.
My son was picked up by police along with his wife from outside our shanty 4 months ago. He did not commit any crime. He has been in a detention center for a long time now. I'm worried for him. The UN Refugee Agency says they are working on the case, but nothing has been done so far. He was working as a day laborer in nearby colonies. He did nothing wrong. I humbly urge for his release. We thank God that India gave us shelter, but there is constant fear of detention in the camp.
In recent weeks, the Delhi High Court ordered a joint inspection of the Rohingya Detention Center in New Delhi by officials of concerned agencies over the alleged lack of basic amenities. The court was hearing a plea of a female refugee who is facing bad health conditions due to the lack of basic facilities in the detention center.
My brother recently got married and he was detained just 3 days after his wedding along with his wife. Since then, he's in a detention center. My mother is blind and she cries every day for him. We have been living here for years and we are grateful to India for giving us refugees. I sell vegetables on the streets and similarly other men do menial work, but we are scared now since detention fear is looming across camps.
Most refugees here have heartbreaking tales of the past and those memories of